Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
This is The Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio on Friday, the 23rd of August, 2024. I'm your host, Marty Gibson, and this week we're going to take a look at the media's role in inflaming and or soothing New Zealand's heightened racial tension as the government plans reforms that impact Māori. We look at artificial intelligence and sports commentary, the media coverage here and abroad of Britain's movement toward that gentle, polite fascism Orwell envisaged in his 1937 treatise, The Road to Wigan Pier. I'll reluctantly talk about Paddy Gower's new job with Stuff. We'll hear some mooing from the advertising industry as they lament the drying of their troughs. And finally, we'll circle back to the coverage of the Tūranga Waewae Hui and the Waitangi Tribunal's complaints about ACT's Treaty Principles Bill. Luckily, I have the gang of three back together. Joining me again today, Rachel Stewart is an ex-New Zealand Herald columnist, the 2016 Opinion Writer of the Year at the Canon Media Awards, and an all-round firebrand. We had a chat yesterday, and I am very envious of her woodland home. I'm still happy in Papamoa. Good morning, Rachel. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, good. At least there's no tsunamis predicted where I am at the moment. But Papamoa, you should be fine. Get on the roof.
Yeah, I'll do something. I've got a kayak. And joining us again after a week off, former broadcaster and now RCR host Peter Williams was a regular fixture on television screens from the late 1970s to 2018, consistently featuring as one of New Zealand broadcasting's most engaging personalities, but he went too far off script and woke up too many other Kiwis and now has this third act here at RCR. Good morning, Peter. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks, Marty. I don't quite know where you come up with that description, but however, you're not far off the mark, I suppose.
There we go.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's get into it. It's been increasingly frustrating reading the media, I find lately, and the Hobson's Choice ad in the New Zealand Herald back in earlier in this month. It seems to be an issue that is a babushka doll of multiple unfolding meanings and almost a fork in the road for New Zealand. This ad came out on August the 7th. It was a front page ad taken out by the lobby group Hobson's Choice and called for the restoration of the foreshore and seabed to public ownership. Because this is such a complex issue, we'll try and keep the Fourth Estate doing what it says on the tin. But there will be some inevitable spillover into wider philosophical, legal, moral, and cultural issues. And as always, Shane Curry's Media Insider column provides, a good insight into the perspective of New Zealand's fawning mainstream journalists cringing in their foxholes and clinging to their public interest journalism funding, which states as a condition of their not having to pay it back that they have to stick with the script that the treaty is a partnership and New Zealand is a racist country that systematically disadvantages Māori. Rachel, what information deficiencies are people on a steady diet of mainstream media suffering from in this, do you think?
You mean in terms of the advert being pulled?
What aren't we hearing? Because it seemed... What was interesting about the commentary to me was there were several Māori commentators in the legal society or legal fraternity saying, well, look, the ad was factually correct in that most of the coastline is subject to claim by Māori. But the thing that was factually incorrect was it's not possible to restore it to Crown ownership because it was never owned by the Crown.
Right. Well, we all know that Don Brash of Hobson's Pledge is not a silly man, not a stupid man. He's a very intelligent man. He doesn't tend to get things right. I don't think by nature he's inflammatory.
Get things wrong.
Right. Yes, he gets to, that's a terrible slip up there. No, he really thinks about what he's doing. And I think that, you know, they don't do these things lightly. Now, I guess the whole issue really is about whether we like advertorials on the front page of our biggest national newspaper. Because of this opens up a huge can of worms, which means, of course, that, you know, I mean, they have done that before, and they've done it with left-wing groups, less more conservative. But now, of course, they're saying they have to go away and look at what they're doing and should they be doing it. And it just seems incredible to me that they haven't sorted this stuff out before. I'm reminded of when I wrote a column about trans stuff, and it caused such a furore that, you know, everyone wanted my job and get cancelled, and they went to Media Council, and it was really just about the self-ID laws under the Birth, Deaths and Marriages that was going to come in, and I wanted to warn New Zealanders what was happening, and it's since happened. So the trans activists caused so much work for the Herald with the Media Council that they told me never to write about it again. And when I did try and write about something very important to do with cancelling at Massey University Speak Up for Women discussions about a year later, they just said they wouldn't run it, and that's when I quit. What I see in NZME is a bunch of cowards, really, who don't know their asses from their elbows, who don't know what they stand for, like the money, of course. Who are all going away now and thinking, oh, what do we do now? And I think we're all poorer for it. They should have had this sorted out. Of course, they tried to say that the advertising responsibility sits with NZME's commercial team, and it's separate to the New Zealand Herald, and the content is a paid ad from an independent advertiser and is clearly labelled. So, you know, but now we're reviewing our processes and policies around advocacy advertising. So there's a lot of work to do for NZME, I believe, and I'm sure you would agree.
It's interesting that you use the word coward. It used to be that if someone called you a coward, you'd duel to the death to clear your name, and it almost seems to be regarded as the honourable response. And I talk about it as a fawning response, where you try and be more like someone who's bullying you in order to placate them. And what that's done, as far as I can tell, is it's created a situation where groups have learned, well, that's the way we have to behave to stimulate that fawning response. And you often see it prompted in terms of, well, why are you so scared of Māori? It's like, no. What do you think, Peter? You've been following this. I saw you did a column recently on it.
Yeah, the point about this particular issue is it's a bit of a conflict here, in that NZME is a publicly listed company, can actually operate the way it desires. It can take advertising, it can refuse advertising. Its annual revenue is what I've just looked it up a few minutes ago, $346.6 million in its 2024 annual report. So it's a big publicly listed company. However, amongst that $346.6 million was $6 million of taxpayer money. Now, that's only 2% of the company's revenue, but there still is some government revenue, some taxpayer revenue amongst its income. Therefore, and that was income received under the PIJF with conditions. I would have thought that if you are going to take any taxpayer money at all, then one of the conditions also of taking that government money is that you should be what the taxpayer union like to call a common carrier. In other words, anybody who comes to you with advertising, which is factually correct, which is advocacy advertising, which is not inciting violence, which is legal, then it should be accepted, because that is one of the conditions of taking the taxpayer money. If you're not going to take any taxpayer money, you can do as you please. You can change your mind as much as you want as well. Obviously, they have, you know, to use Rachel's rather colloquial term, NZME have been a bunch of cowards here. I like to call it by its other term. It is the thug's veto. They took some advertising because they liked the money, and then a whole lot of activists got very upset about it. So there was a massive outcry from the predictable sources, and NZB says, oh, sorry, we didn't really mean to do that. We didn't want to hurt your feelings. So we say we're not going to take any more money from Hobson's pledge. And that's pretty much where it stands at the moment. Now they're saying they're going to review all their advocacy advertising. Let's see at the next election if the Council of Trade Unions can get a front page wraparound. Can Stand Up for Women get a front page wraparound? Can Family First get front page advertising? Whether or not you have the advertising as a wraparound on the front cover or inside the paper itself, to me, makes absolutely no difference. I believe that you should be allowed to have advocacy advertising as long, as I said before, it's got those conditions, it is factually correct, and it is not inciting violence. I don't see what the problem is, but NZB management have essentially here bowed to the thug's veto, and they've done themselves out of $25,000. So, their problem.
There's always that element of doing or accusing the opposition what you yourself are doing as well. I saw Matthew Tukaki said that they'd accepted a payment for what was essentially an advertisement sowing division between Māori and non-Māori. And there's Debbie Nare Wapaka said that Hobson's pledge was, it's their racism is well known. This is a lady who's a leader of a race-based party.
Yeah, I know. The old saying about pots and kettles comes to mind when you hear any utterance from either Matthew Tukaki or from Debbie Nare Wapaka or Rari Waititi or any members of Te Pāti Māori. They are a race-based party. They advocate for the interests of some Māori, and that's fine. That's what you can do in a democratic society. Just let everybody have their say on the other side of the argument. And frankly, it should be for the media. Remember, what is the media supposed to be? The clue is in the word, Marty. It's the media. It's the one in the middle. It's the medium, right? So we're not. The media is not supposed to be one side or the other. It's supposed to be there to present all sides of the argument. By shutting down one side of the argument through paid advocacy advertising, the media is not doing its job. But then the counter-argument to that, the counterfactual to that, I come back to what I said before. NZME is a publicly listed organization which does not have any government ownership. It has some government revenue, but it has no government ownership, so therefore it can do as it likes. TVNZ, as 100% government-owned, should accept, and I would have thought must accept, advertising from an outfit like Hobson's Pledge. Hobson's Pledge have decided that there is more effective advertising in a wraparound of a newspaper, despite the failing sales or the dropping sales of a newspaper. They believe that's a way more effective form of getting their message across than having an expensive 30-second advertisement in prime time on TV, which is here one lot of 30 seconds and gone on the next lot of 30 seconds. So they've decided where the most effective form of advertising or advocacy is, and it's going to be in the paper. The Herald doesn't have to accept it, but if they're really doing their job as a proper media company, in other words, in the middle, accepting both sides of the story, they should be running that advertising.
Absolutely. And I think just to say that Te Pāti Māori want an apology before they'll ever, you know, deal with the NZME ever again. Well, wait and see. I think Te Pāti Māori are a little bit, well, actually, I think they're crazy. But
full stop. A bit precious, aren't they?
Rather. But, you know, the usual suspects cried out, and as I say, the cowards just capitulated to that. So here we are.
The danger in having cowards in not only the media, but in politics and in academia and increasingly in corporate life, as we see with NZME generally, is that they get out of step with the mood of the nation. And so when those other sides of the argument aren't represented, there's an increasing build-up of tension. And I've been reading Muriel Newman's excellent work on this, and that would be such a welcome addition to the debate. And when you read what she says about the situation with the Coastal Area Act, it is something that all New Zealanders have an interest in. And we really, if we're not discussing it, if there is that thug's veto, and you know, it appears our media and politicians being cowed into just accepting it on our behalf, something that will potentially, I mean, they're sure that it's not going to deny us access to the beach, but who knows what caveats are behind that. If you pay, if we approve, if we don't disapprove, I don't think that there's sufficient trust at this stage, given the shutting down of discussion, to accept them at their word.
Yeah, that's the key to it. There's a very good explainer in the Herald this morning by Audrey Young about what customary marine title actually means. Yes, it allows full access to the beach for the public. Yes, it allows fishing to happen from, what is it, the high water mark out to the 12-mile limit. So there is no public access to the beach denied. Although, of course, during the time of that Helen Clark legislation, the old Foreshore and Coastal Act, sorry, Foreshore and Seabed Act from 2004 to 2011, it was in public ownership. Now it's what, nobody owns the beach kind of thing. So the customary marine title is not denying public access, but it does allow iwi to have certain rights. And some of those rights include being able to put, the word of wahi, not a wahi.
Wahi tapu.
Yeah, wahi tapu on it, which means it can deny public access. So, and even though that has got to go through a court, you know which way the courts are leaning on these issues. So there is, I think, genuine concern about the intentions of what the Marine and Coastal Areas Act could lead to. And the government, in its current legislation, basically just wants to go back, particularly the test about exclusive and continuous use or ownership of the beach, going back to of that particular part of the coastal area, going back to 1840. Because remember the famous line, and what was it, the Court of Appeal or the High Court decision, which said there is, iwi can have shared exclusivity. Mm. I call that an oxymoronic phrase. I mean, how the hell can you have shared exclusivity? But this is one of the concepts that our learned friends in the judiciary have come up with on this particular matter, which is absolutely against what the Parliament legislated for 13 years ago. And the Parliament at the moment, and it's been, you know, confirmed that, yes, Parliament is sovereign. Parliament is the highest court in the land. Parliament just wants to clean up and reinforce what it meant to say 2011 and not giving a way for the court to get in the way.
Mm. I mean, it's worth reiterating what we're talking about here. The Marine and Coastal Area Act, this is from Muriel Newman's article, covers the distance between the average spring high tide waterline and the 12 nautical mile limit of the territorial sea, along with the airspace above, the water space, and the subsoil, bedrock, and mineral wealth below. It's essentially 10 million hectares of the richest natural resources in the country, a literal food basket, transportation network, security zone, and treasure chest of invaluable non-nationalized minerals, including iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, and rare earths. That's why every square inch of the coast has been claimed many times over by hundreds of tribal groups. So there's a lot at stake here. So yeah, it is worrisome that debate is being shut down.
But we should also remember Marty, there are some nationalised minerals as well. So I know you referred to a list of minerals there and rare earth metals and the like, but some of them are nationalised and some of them will be government property and not exclusively for the use of whoever gets the customary marine title. But nevertheless, your point is valid. There is an awful lot, millions, billions of dollars at stake here. And that's really what the guts of the matter is about.
I'll just move on. My printer's malfunctioned, so I'm having to scroll on my computer. I'm just that little bit too old to be adept with IT. I'm sorry.
Have you not got four fingers on each hand, Marty, or not?
The nature of this discussion is that once you start reading, there's so much to clip out. There's so much pertinent information. So I'm left with quite a lot to scroll through. But we'll get to the second less contentious topic for discussion today. Whenever we start getting wound up because people are sneakily toiling to take our rights away, we should maybe refocus on the things we're told matter. In this case, the question is, should AI virtual sports anchors take the place of human commentators, human anchors? And this is an article from MediaTek, which reads, AI virtual sports anchors have efficiency advantages, but the personality charm of human anchors is difficult to replace. The Paris Olympic Games will take the lead, introducing a revolutionary innovation. Virtual sports anchors are officially on the job, opening a new chapter in AI commentary. And I read this and I thought, is there a danger that AI commentators might suffer glitches and be honest? You know, if they say, look at the man with the ball, human, direct your passion and outrage into that. Do not notice your health, wealth, and rights being eroded by a group of Satanists who think there are too many of you, as I do also. He was not offside. That was a poor decision.
Very good. Thing about AI, Marty, is that it's come a wee bit beyond the robots that you've just indulged in.
They'll appropriate your voice, won't they, Peter?
Yeah.
Or it might say, oh, that's actually a man punching a woman in the boxing ring. You know, that's actually a man. He's, you know, we don't want that. No, we want the Peter Williamses, don't we, Peter? Because, well, you know what I think of artificial insemination. Sorry, AI. I think it's crazy stuff. And I say no. I just say no. Go, Peter, because this is your specialist subject.
Well, indeed it is. And I don't know, you guys all might be old enough to remember a show. I think it was probably about 40 years ago in the early 1980s called Max Headroom. Now, yes. Max Headroom was essentially the automated, the robot anchorman. And Max Headroom was, for those who don't work in television, just a bit of a play on words, because when a studio director says to a cameraman, give me Max Headroom, which is short for give me maximum headroom. In other words, just enough space in the shot above the top of the head to the top of the frame to make sure it doesn't look stupid. So that's Max Headroom, and that's where...
I didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Something every day. So that's where the name came from. And that was basically a piss take of the future. Well, the future is here, folks. And AI was put about by NBC at the Paris Olympics. I have to say I didn't hear or see anything, but having seen what modern-day animation can do, I would suspect you would not be able to tell too much difference between the AI anchorman, the AI front person, and the real human front person. What's even better is that they used the voice of a very famous American sportscaster called, ironically, L. Michaels. And when you write L, as in uppercase A, lowercase L, it looks like uppercase A, uppercase I. In other words, AI. But,
right.
But his name is L. Michaels. He's a famous sportscaster. They've taken samples of his voice, put it through the computer, and it's the voice of L. Michaels, which is the anchorman, the commentator for it. But it's like with everything in this computer-driven world, this algorithm-driven world, it's rubbish in, rubbish out, isn't it? So if there is only a particular, shall we say, philosophy of sports broadcasting, put into the system. It's only a particular philosophy of sports broadcasting which is going to come out. Therefore, Rachel, it will never talk about an Algerian boxer with an XY chromosome should not being in the female competition. So you're not going to get honesty, because it's only the facts that have been fed into the computer which allowed it to come out the other end. Oh. Did I explain that very well? Maybe somebody in AI would have explained that better.
No, very good. I learned a whole lot of stuff just then, actually.
I can't imagine you watching much sport out in the woods, Rachel.
No, although I do have a satellite Wi-Fi, so I can stream. So, yeah, I'm pretty connected, actually. Got the Wi-Fi, right. And but I don't tend to watch too much sport these days because, well, I just don't. It's become boring to me, unfortunately. I think rugby's just, which I used to really enjoy, has just become so, the rules are just ridiculous now. Mm. It's just so, I mean, here we are again, TMOs and all that stuff, you know, modern, where the ref is completely disregarded and they can go back and say, oh, no, we're going to not give you that try you made 2 minutes ago or 4 minutes ago while they're still playing. I just find the whole thing just does my head in.
My suspicion is that sport is the magician's beautiful assistant distracting me from the magician making things disappear, including my freedom.
Yes.
Back to our rights being taken away, and specifically the media coverage of the UK riots and free speech. The Guardian had a breathless article which reads, "Police are monitoring social media commentary and people are going to jail for it." But also, this is not from the Guardian. This is the question arising from it. Police officers are watching TikTok in an attempt to catch far-right demonstrators live streaming self-incriminating footage of their illegal behavior. The police source said other material being used as evidence included CCTV, officers' body cam footage, drone footage, and video posted on other online platforms by those supporting the violence and those opposing fascism. They said retrospective facial recognition was also in use. So the dystopia is here, isn't it?
It really is. It's this is probably the most frightening thing so far this year for me to watch unfolding. And certainly we should be very worried, because I don't think this is a one-off to England. I think this is a worldwide movement. It is totalitarianism. It is anti-democratic. When people can't democratically protest something as important as boats arriving and governments not doing anything about it with migrants, then you've lost it. You're in a totally different realm. I mean, there are people going to jail right now for Facebook posts that are just showing somebody else's, re-upping them, tweets that are just re-upping them. That's a fact. David Spring, 61, ex-train driver, I've been watching his story quite a bit. He's just been made a sacrificial lamb. If you Google him, you'll find very little other than anti-David Spring stories pop up. But this man did nothing wrong apart from saying, who the F is Allah? From what I can see in a breakdown of the whole incident with the police, there's hardly an incident. I mean, you can't, these people are getting locked up for 18 months. They're getting jail sentences that are harder and harsher than pedophiles. Pedophiles are even being let out of prison, excuse me, to make space for these far right thugs, so that's the narrative. That's what we're seeing. This is incredibly dangerous stuff. And even, I don't know if you've heard of Jonathan Friedland. He writes for The Guardian. He has he wrote an article early August saying that Elon Musk should be gone after for allowing these tweets to be criticising what the government's doing. I mean, this is where we've got to. And if New Zealanders think that we're going to be immune to this, I just say, think again. And, you know, I look at the Free Speech Union and I think, good on you, but I think you're farting against thunder at the moment. And I think this is a worldwide thing, and it's not going to stop in Britain. So that's my view on that.
Yeah, it's incredibly well-resourced, yes, isn't it, and yes, well-organised. And I wonder, you know, whether often these things are almost Asian provocateurs rather than the primary issue. Peter, have you been following this with white knuckles?
Well, I was staggered by the case of a 53-year-old grandmother who, very similar to Rachel's case, sent to jail, I think, for 15 months, essentially for liking a Facebook post that was in regard to either one of the provocateurs of the recent riots in the UK, or it was a topic about some of the recent riots. But, you know, the issue in Britain at the moment is immigration, or more to the point, illegal immigration, and the way that the government is allowing these people who arrive on the boats to stay in flash hotels and get lots of benefits straight away. And understandably, British taxpayers are pretty frustrated about that. Now, that particular case is not going to happen in New Zealand because we are, luckily, physically, so far away from people being able to come here safely on tin pot boats. So we're never going to have an influx of illegal immigrants in that respect. But there are issues ashore which may well blow up into similar things. And I think at the top of that list, are Maori issues, treaty issues, and the general issue of race relations. And we've already seen it, as we were discussing earlier in this program, that the moment you start offering a counter view to what is becoming more and more the accepted narrative on race relations and on the standing of the Treaty of Waitangi and on what the Treaty of Waitangi actually means, then you are having, you know, you are in danger of being shut down, of being deplatformed very quickly. And therefore, your free speech rights are being taken away. Now, we haven't, thankfully, at this stage, got to having people locked up for expressing opinions such as that. But we've seen it happen in Britain. You think, how the hell, in one of the homes of modern democracy, the place of the Enlightenment, how the hell have we ever come to having grandmothers put in prison for liking something on a Facebook page? I mean, that is absurd. But do we get to the situation in New Zealand where if you start expressing opinions, something like Don Brash's and Hobson's pledge, are you going to be locked up as well? God, you would hope not. But the trend has started. The slippery slope may be underway. Hopefully, we're right at the bottom of that slippery slope, and it never, ever comes to this, that things flatten out before they get to that stage where you can get put in prison for expressing an opinion about Maori issues or about the Treaty of Waitangi. But, you know, I remember taking part in a so-called debate. This would have been 2019, 2020, when I was living in Auckland? No, I was living in Tauranga, but I came to Auckland to take part in this particular debate about climate change. And I was being thrown into the lion's den. It was in the heart of deepest, darkest Ponsonby, and I was arguing that climate alarmism is something that was way overhyped and that we should not worry too much about the impending doom that was coming upon the world because of anthropogenic climate change, or anthropogenic global warming. And there were people in that same panel who said, you should not be saying that. You should be deplatformed. And I just laughed at them and went off into the night and thought, well, that's weird. I mean, those people have a very warped outlook on life. But, you know, 4 years on, there are still
laughing now.
Things like that. In fact, they probably think even more seriously about that kind of attitude, that people of my thinking should be deplatformed. Thankfully, not yet, not locked up. But who knows what they might eventually think about the views that I hold.
Well, I mean, I had the police at my doorstep because of, you know, a tweet. So, in, 2 years ago. So, and they took my firearms and I had to pay $15,000 to get them back. So, well,
tell us about that, Rachel.
Oh, you know, I don't know if you've heard that story, but I did a tweet in 21, 22, maybe 21, 21. And it was a joke tweet, and it was a trope on the Thelma and Louise thing where, you know, I'm going to get my gun-toting sisters over and make this little man run around naked in a paddock, and we'll get the girls on the back drinking, hollering, and, you know, it was just complete and utter joke. And anyone who knows me on Twitter knows how I roll. And so the trans activists all got together on Twitter. They all went after me. They even said they were doing that. The police got like 300 or something planned and calculated complaints on their 555 or one of those online things. 6 weeks later, knock on the door, took my firearms license because clearly I was threatening to kill a trans person or something. Took my guns, and I had to go to Franks and Ogilvie, Stephen Franks, and spent $15,000 to prove that I was a fit and proper person to have my firearms back. I'd never had a history of any problems, and that was calculated from that column that I wrote in NZME, who also shut me down and censored me. So the trans issue is pretty close to be honest, to the Maori issue. Oh, lots of issues, really. So that's my story. And my guns are now safely here and locked up in their little cabinets. And I spent that money because it could not stand. It could not stand for me, and it cannot stand for New Zealanders.
No.
And the police just absolutely hammered me. Yep. So that's my story, Peter.
Not known for their sense of humour in terms of jokes about firearms either, are they?
No. But I think what they had is a guy called Rona Stace, who's... Well, I'm going to call him a guy because that's what he is, but he's a trans officer in there. They're now employing trans police, by the way. Yep. So we've got a lot of trans women running around being cops now. Men dressed as women, cops. And he was terribly involved in this. So, you know, it's the police is a whole other issue, and so are the firearms laws. But I'm sure we'll get there one day.
Paul Brennan. Had a fantastic guest on his breakfast show on Wednesday, author and co-founder of Architects for Social Housing, Simon Elmer. And he, it was quite shocking actually, prefaced the interview with a disclaimer to avoid prosecution under Section 179 of Britain's Online Safety Act, and then quoted Section 180 that legally absolves broadcasters, and stated the source of his data, and said that he didn't intend to cause non-trivial harm, emotional or physical. The interesting point he made was that last year about 80,000 people came into Britain as asylum seekers, but about 423,000 came in on work permits and with dependents, and another 389,000 came in on study permits, with a further 75,000 family members coming over to join existing immigrants. So, you know, we think about...
Hang on, Artie, I'm trying to add this up, but I'm thinking that's over a million people.
Yeah, it's the population of Glasgow added to Britain each year. So, I mean, if I would encourage, if you're interested in this, to go back and have a listen to that interview. It's fantastic and chilling. But he was making the point. This is not something which is out of the government's control or happening illegally. It's a policy that's been set by a transnational technocracy to adjust the balance between the working and retired population, also the working population, and the profits of people employing them. And he said by 2050, the native population of Great Britain, as people born there, so not white or anything, will be a minority. And that's true of most Western countries. The Great Replacement has been denounced as a white nationalist, far-right conspiracy theory, delusional, racist, and one that directly influences perpetrators of violence. And that's the key to it. He was saying there's a characterization as anyone who resists is a perpetrator of violence. And it turns out it's not a conspiracy theory, it's UN policy.
Mm. Well, it's happening in New Zealand too, isn't it? I mean, we don't have boat people, we don't have illegal immigrants, we don't have asylum seekers, but the point is we still have, through the processes of immigration in New Zealand, somewhere between 70 and 130,000 people annually coming to take up permanent residence in this country. And that's net, because I think the actual number is somewhere up around 200,000, isn't it? coming in and about 70,000 leaving. So yeah, the replacement, the look of New Zealand is changing before our eyes. Not necessarily where I live, because it's still pretty much as it's always been down here in the south. But I don't say I hate to think, but I can imagine, only imagine, what's happening around Auckland, Waikato Bay of Plenty, Marty. Maybe you see it in your day-to-day life living just out of Tauranga.
Well, it's mainly, I think, the impact on housing and the impact on congestion of an inadequate roading system and the stress on the education system. They really haven't thought it through. And he said, you know, in 1997 when Tony Blair came to power, I've got to remember who Tony Blair's acolyte was as well. Jacinda was learning at his knee. When he came to power, immigration was about 50,000 a year, and he immediately increased that to 150,000, and it stayed there for a while. In 2004, the EU was opened up to Eastern Europe as well, and a large number arrived, but crime actually lowered at that point because the crime rate in Eastern Europe's lower. But since 2013, crime rates have consistently gone up because they're importing people from places which have high crime rates. In UK, the murder rates are about 1.148 per 100,000, and they're getting immigrants from Rwanda and Zimbabwe, where it's 6.64, Nigeria, where it's 21, Jamaica, where it's 53, and you know, you're getting a Glasgow each year of people from that, and ghettos are forming, and there are problems of alienation on both sides. And so, yeah, that's what the British people are protesting.
Mm. Well, in New Zealand, we're having a Palmerston North added every year, aren't we?
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Heaven forbid, a Palmerston North every year. Couldn't you have said something like, you know, Nelson or something?
Morrowtown.
Poor Palmerston North, sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting other complexion to it is the Islamic dimension. You know, in Islam, foreign countries are called Dar al-Harb, which means house of war. Mm. And at the moment, Britain is seen to be in a proxy war against Palestine, and so that's another tinderbox. So,
well, oil and water don't mix, and Christianity and Islam will never mix, and it's just a fact. We just don't. Christian countries, or at least that's our beginnings, and still forms the basis of who we are. Although that's slipping away, I guess. I mean, this is going to be if the elites and the media think that this is all going to be lovely jubbly and we'll all be singing kumbaya together, you know, in Britain, they'll all be happy. They're dreaming. They're going to find out the hard way, because Islam is not Christian.
I think you're being charitable, assuming that it's an unintended consequence by the people who are perpetrating it.
Yes, I am, but because I can't actually think why, I struggle to think why they're letting so many Muslims in. I can't. Why do you think? I mean, I don't understand why they want this conflict.
Well, it's the same fawning response.
Yes, it is.
It's to get people to have a fawning response. And my theory, which I espoused on Media Matters this week, was that, again, these groups are being used as agents provocateur. They're getting people ready to be herded into the neo-feudalist pens, because there are similarities to the philosophy. It's not democratic. It's authoritarian. And Simon's closing remarks were that, you know, the UK police force is now political. They'll let criminals go free in order to imprison people who protest the government's immigration policies. And you know, they're characterising political demonstrations now as acts of criminality. And he said, The real danger is not from immigrants, but corporations throwing large numbers of people into our countries with no concerns for the consequences. So, that's a real problem. And I see the New Zealand media's failure to cover it as such as a problem.
The New Zealand media does not really understand, I don't believe, the situation in Britain as much as it doesn't really understand exactly what's going on in the United States at the moment either. But in terms of bringing it back to what may or may not happen in this country, the point is that we are not being overrun by Islamic immigration. We are being... We are having lots of our immigrants coming from where? Fiji, the Philippines, India, and China. So there is no religious aspect really to where our immigrants are coming from. It's just that our country is going to look a lot different. So New Zealand is, because of basically the color of the skin of the population. So therefore, it's going to look a lot different to the New Zealand that I grew up in 40 years ago, 50 years ago as a young person. So I don't think we're going to have the religious aspect. I don't think we've got the Islamic matter coming too much of a head in this country. And some might say, thank goodness for that. But we're still going to have just the general unease of the white population seeing so many brown faces around the country. Now, I know in parts of the country, it's been going on forever.
And also, what fascinates me is that Maori consider you racist, anyone racist if they raise the immigration matters. But they're the ones who are missing, those are Indigenous people are the ones who are going to miss out on the housing
and the jobs
and the opportunities, the jobs. Yeah. And they, it's like they haven't woken up to that yet. So that's another storm coming, I think.
Yeah, there's a problem over in Porikei where they established a mussel farm. There was a great hue and cry that it was creating jobs for locals, but the locals wouldn't do the job. No. So they've gotten people from the islands in to do it. So there's a few shocks. I mean, my wife she's British but is Indian, so she sounds like she's off Coronation Street. But culturally, she's Western. The people often say, oh, you must get really tasty. Does your wife make you tasty curries?
Oh, and
like that? So, you know, the fact that she married the largest, whitest skinhead she could find is not a good predictor that she's going to be a keeper of the culture. And so it is cultural. And I think often things are characterized as race, where really it's a cultural thing, and it's a distraction in some ways. I think that happens with Maori issues. I think a lot of what Maori characterise as racist is actually the visceral reaction of people with a proud history of abolishing slavery and deposing tyrants to being talked to like slaves by people who seem to aspire to be tyrants.
Yeah, well put. Well put.
Speaking of the mainstream media, and this is the part I said I was not as enthusiastic to discuss as all that, but Paddy Gow has got a job at Stuff. It's taken 6 weeks and 5 days and lots of meetings, proposals, patient explanations and tears, but journalist Paddy Gow has landed a job at Stuff.
Yawning.
Yeah. That's nice, Marty. Next topic.
All right. next and final topic, government.
Sorry, I don't mean to be dismissive, but so what?
It's just...
Man gets job. Wow, that's never happened before.
What makes Paddy Gow dangerous, in my mind anyway, is his midwittery, his resentment at the world, apparently, and his thirst to fit in and for approval, especially the approval of women, and how aggressive he is willing to be to hold on to the inexplicable gains he's made in becoming a TV personality. I often contrast him with RCR hosts and point out that the big difference is we're more famous than we want to be.
Midwittery is perfect. Midwittery.
Yeah, I was driving along Papamoa Beach on Wednesday, listening to the news. As I said, I listened to the breakfast show, and I was listening to the news being very professionally read, and I forgot I was listening to RCR. I just thought, man, that's some great news sense behind this. It felt nourishing and balanced, and it felt like a sincere effort at journalism rather than cynically saccharine mind control. And in that moment, when I re-remembered that I was listening to RCR, I realized we're winning. It's just a matter of holding the course, being vigilant, and not making any unforced errors, and surviving financially as our audience builds. So, yeah, I find increasingly watching some of those legacy media takes on things, it's so jarring when you've got access to, whether it's through X or RCR, actual analysis that's in good faith.
Mm-hmm. I heard a NZME bulletin the other morning. I forget which station it was on, but I swear that the news, this was in relation to the local government conference in Wellington. I swear the news reader said that the local government conference wanted either less interference or more money from the federal government. I kid you not, the word federal was used in reference to our central government. Now, I mean, what kind of thicko imbecilic system allows that word to get through from a junior reporter to the sub to the news presenter who's supposed to be experienced and worldly? How the hell can the word federal in reference to our central government ever get on a news bulletin? I mean, that is just stupidity of the highest order. And that's just an example of what's going on in modern day media. It's just like a factory producing eggs. Every now and then there's a very smelly one.
Most of the subbing, I think, is done in the PR offices, which I think is where a great proportion of media comes from now. And there are some clangers get through. I mean, I saw there was one where it's talking about the wealth in New Zealand, and a reporter had said that an Auckland couple took a cruise that was going to cost them $500 million. It's like, that's pretty basic.
It speaks to the caliber of people being churned out, doesn't it? It's just, I mean, is this what globalism does? Makes you think that we have a federal government? I don't know.
Well, it's that Aldous Huxley contrast to George Orwell's vision of information being tightly controlled, where Huxley thought there'd just be so much, we'd just be getting hosed at us to the extent that we'd just become numb to it. And I think that's what seems to be happening. The final topic quickly was that there's a hue and cry among advertising executives because they are not getting as much money from the government. These are some of the people who bought us such gems recently as the stay home messaging from the Ministry of Health that we would have seen incessantly.
Oh, how sad. I feel very sorry for them. Oh, terrible.
My favourite thing of Cam Slater is, let me just wipe away this tiny
tear. Yeah, that's
tear.
Really all I have to say about the matter. I mean, they've been troughing it for so long. It's time to take the trough away. How sad. Never mind.
And it's that terrible dawning understanding that Kiwis are going to have to increasingly arrive at, that they're not the customers of media companies. It's the advertisers who are the customers. And that is what allows that jarring disapproval of the media by most people.
Well, there was that extraordinary figure released by Simeon Brown when he was in opposition. Now, when was this? February or March of 2022, I seem to believe. I was at a time just after I'd left a full-time job in the media, and he revealed that the government spending over the prior 12 months, the government spending on advertising, was $125 million. Now, obviously, most of that was Ministry of Health. A good deal of it was from Ministry of Transport, of course, with their drink driving and drug driving campaigns, but the vast majority of it was from the Ministry of Health during the COVID era. Now, you put $125 billion into context. In a usual year, the biggest advertiser in New Zealand is somebody like Harvey Norman or Toyota, KFC, McDonald's, Telecom or Spark or whatever, and they spend somewhere between 75 million at the upper limit down to about 50 million. If you look at the list of the biggest advertising spenders in New Zealand, it was the government coming in over the top and being 50% higher than the usual biggest advertiser in the country, as in Harvey Norman with their wraparound newspaper ads. So that's why there are whales of complaint, whales of pain now, because the gravy train has been turned off. And thankfully, not before bloody time.
Yeah, it never got talked about, did it? We heard a lot about the Public Interest Journalism Fund. Didn't hear about the fact that the government were paying full rack price for full-page ads. That they didn't negotiate. I mean, they're talking here that there's expected cuts of 20%. But there was just that gleeful spraying of money, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was no bulk buy discount at the time, which was just ludicrous in terms of the way that people should be managing our money.
Yeah, look where we are now. Financially.
Yeah.
But it kept them in line. I think we're out of time, but thanks very much for joining me this morning. Have you got anything that you'd like to say in closing to cap off the week, or any thoughts to send us away with?
Oh, just let's hope it gets better, but I don't think it will.
Peter?
Well, the thing about living in the Independent Republic of the South Island, or more to the point, the Independent Republic of Central Otago, is that you can let the world go by and it doesn't actually matter a hell of a lot. You might have heard a report the other day, Marty, that economic growth in Otago and Southland is about 1%. Which is quite a lot higher than the rest of the country. So we just don't want to tell anybody about it. We're more than happy down here. Thank you very much.
Good on you.
Well, I might walk down to the beach and get some tour tours.
Very good.
Thanks very much. Have a great week.
Yeah, you too, Marty.
Yeah.
Okay, bye. See you guys.
You've been listening to The Fourth Estate right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio. Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.